Well, good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm David Eisenbutt, as was mentioned, Director of the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute, MSRI for short, and I'll be your moderator. Tonight's program is being held in association with the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute. And I'm delighted and honored to be able to sit next to Roger Penrose and tell you a little bit about him. We're here, of course, because on the occasion of his new book, Fashion, Faith, and Fantasy in the New Physics of the Universe. Roger was knighted in 1994 for his fundamental contributions to physics, but long ago he started as a mathematician. He was a student of W.V.D. Hodge in Cambridge, I believe, and worked in algebraic geometry in his beginning and was seduced into cosmology. Perhaps we'll hear how in this conversation. He is an inspired artist as well as a wonderful writer and a great physicist. In fact, in his early days as a child, he was busy drawing and doing things, and he saw an exhibition of M.C. Escher's work and was then inspired to design the famous tri-bar, this funny, impossible triangle, which is really one of the best illustrations of the problems of local versus global geometry that I've ever seen. Anyway, he communicated his discoveries to Escher. He had a correspondence, and Escher's waterfall and up and down, two of his most famous woodcuts, are based on Roger's ideas. As I say, he went into cosmology, and we'll talk a lot about that. Kip Thorne, the famous physicist, said in 64 that Roger Penrose has revolutionized the mathematical tools that we use to analyze space-time. Roger brought differential topology into that subject and proved some wonderful theorems using it. He shared the Wolf Prize with Stephen Hawking and innumerable other prizes. I will not list them all. He invented twister theory, bringing complex analysis to bear on Minkowski space and combining them. He invented wonderful notions. He has a way with words, too, such as cosmic censorship. Will we hear about cosmic censorship? In the art world, he's also famous for Penrose tilings, the non-periodic tilings that you can make with just two shapes. And if you walk by the Transbay Terminal, maybe even now, but certainly soon, you'll see it's covered with a Penrose tiling, which is quite a neat feat, given that it's not a flat surface. Roger was there on a tour today. Nature, of course, was jealous of this and promptly created quasicrystals to imitate this wonderful art. So we're back and forth there. Roger has written quite a number of books, popular books and technical ones. The Emperor's New Mind caught lots of people's attention and became very controversial, too. He wrote Shadows of the Mind subsequently, and The Large, the Small, and the Human Mind, the last with Hawking. He then wrote The Road to Reality, which tries, and I think in some measure succeeds, to explain all of mathematics and physics. That's a remarkable task. He wrote Cycles of Time, explaining one of his new ideas about the universe, the fate, the long-term fate of the universe. Interesting question for us. And finally, Fashion, Faith, and Fantasy in the New Physics of the Universe. There are some technical books along the way, lots and lots of papers. He really deserves his reputation as a great physicist. So, fashion, faith, and fantasy. This is really a basic question about what science is, right? I mean, the notion of science, what does a scientist do? Of course, we all know, scientists carefully observes the universe, studies what's out there, makes deductions, comes up with true facts about the universe. Doesn't seem to be quite like that. And the notions of fashion, faith, and fantasy suggest some of the ways which it's not. So I thought we could begin by talking about those words. Fashion. What's fashion got to do with science?
Well, I was particularly aiming these words at particular topics, these topics being what I would call big fish in the area of theoretical physics.
So what are the big fish?
First fish was actually string theory, but I should make clear, it's not really string theory I was worried about. It was the fact that I should explain what string theory is, first of all. In ordinary physics, you might talk about particles, and these particles we think thought of as points. And then as time progresses, if you have time, hard to draw it because you have three dimensions, you have to sacrifice one of the space dimensions and think of it as a time dimension. So it usually goes up in my relativity circles, although particle physicists make it go to the left, but that's never mind about that. Sorry, that's the right. I'm never quite sure which way around. That's the right, yes. but anyway, you have these pictures, which are referred to as Feynman diagrams, and each of those represent their lines, and each line represents the history of a particle. Another one comes along, and then it may combine to make a third, that may break apart and make a fourth, and they can do all sorts of things like that. And each one of these pictures represents a mathematical expression. Now, they work fine, and you can get all sorts of wonderful answers using these things, but the trouble is that most of them are technically, the answer is infinite, and that's not much use. There are all sorts of clever ways of getting around making them infinite and subtracting things off and so on, but that's not very satisfactory. And the people in string, the idea, original idea of string theory was not to think of these particle trajectories as little one-dimensional lines like that, but as little tubes. And these tubes represent little loops, the history of a loop going along like that. But then that might split up and join together, and you imagine a bit of plumbing of some sort, you see, with these pipes coming together. And instead of having diagrams which lead you to mathematical expressions which are infinite, you find that you get expressions which are completely finite. And it's a wonderful idea. And when I was first told about this, I thought, yeah, that's wonderful, amazing, and I hope that things take off with this idea. That was fine until I learned that it didn't quite work unless space had 25 dimensions. Well, time is one more, so space-time is 26 dimensions. And that, to me, didn't make any sense. Well, you see, of course, all the extra dimensions were not meant to be things you'd see. They'd be tied up in little knots that you don't actually think, and they'd be so small knots that you wouldn't be aware of, and that's the way people thought about it. But it didn't make sense to me for a different reason, which had to do with ideas I'm not going to explain to you here, but it's what's called functional freedom, the amount of degrees of freedom that your fields have. And if you've got more space dimensions, it completely swamps anything you had before. And it seemed to me that this was a terrible nuisance. But then people said, oh, well, you've got quantum mechanics, it doesn't quite work. Anyway, I think I'll have to direct you to my book to see why, really, I thought the idea didn't work at a deep level. It wasn't just that, as some people complain, that it has no predictions, which is true also, but that what didn't really make sense is a mathematical theory. So it's not so much that it was fashionable, because it was fashionable, and that might be good if it was a theory that I believed made sense, you see. But I always thought there were fundamental problems with it, and is that a good thing? A lot of people are doing it because the mathematics is beautiful, or at least some of it is, and that is one of the reasons that it was fashionable. So I think
isn't fashion in some way a way of saying how you decide on what problems to work on? It seems to me that some element of fashion is necessary for working scientists.
Well, I think in pure mathematics, it's fine, and fashion, an element of it, is very important because, after all, in mathematics, you're exploring the mathematical universe, if you like. When I say universe there, I mean just the world of mathematical ideas and how they fit together and so on. And then having a lot of people working on some area means that a lot of progress is likely to happen. And that's fine, because that's what you're trying to do. Whereas in physics, if a lot of people are working on some area and it doesn't actually relate to the world in a direct way, then that's not so good. So the problem I was having in the physics is that it's not clear that the fashion is for a good reason. I mean, mathematics, it doesn't matter so much, because that you're trying to explore mathematics, mm-hmm. and it can be fashionable, that's fine. It's where you can perhaps go more deeply into the mathematical area, just because a lot of people are working on it and coming up with ideas that they might not have thought of individually. But in the case of this case that I worried about, in the string theory case, was that a lot of people were working on it for pure mathematical reasons, which in a sense is fine, because we've discovered that pure mathematical ideas have tremendous impact on the way the world works. In fact, as far as we know, the world works in a way which is completely in accordance with mathematical notions. But there are only certain mathematical notions, and they may not be the ones which turn out to be fashionable. So there's a sort of misfit there. But the thing is, if I'd felt that this higher-dimensional stuff was actually hanging together in a sensible way, I wouldn't have worried so much. It's just that I had problems with it.
Yes.
Then faith, I suppose.
Let's talk about faith, yes.
Well, you see, it's completely different, because one of the other troubles with string theory is that it doesn't have any implications that people can measure with, you know, accelerators. I mean, the energies you need are way out of the scale that anybody could think of. So it's not testable in any direct way. So that's, some people object for that reason. My objection was really rather different. I'm saying, okay, that's true too, but does it hang together? Now, the faith is completely different, because it had to do with quantum mechanics. Now, quantum mechanics is an incredible subject which has an incredible number of implications. You know, your laptops, your cell phones, your GPS, many, many things depend crucially on effects that we couldn't understand at all before quantum mechanics came along. So quantum mechanics has amazing implications in many, many different areas. But the trouble with quantum mechanics is it doesn't hang together when you think about large things. And you wanted to ask me about my picture. Shall I come
yes,
to it here?
The mermaid, yes, the little mermaid.
Yes.
And I have to say that in the book, which I meant
yes,
to have a copy to wave around.
It's also on the back cover.
And on the back cover, there's a wonderful illustration which represents in some way all of quantum mechanics.
Well, the back cover one is one that I should explain that first, because I was asked by the Hans Christian Andersen Society whether I would give a lecture to them. The thing was that Hans Christian Andersen was coming up to his 200th anniversary, and they wanted lectures in honor of this. Well, you see, I didn't think of myself as an expert on literature or fairy tales or something. But it is true that I had written a book called The Emperor's New Mind, and The Emperor's New Mind, the title came from The Emperor's New Clothes, and so this was a key idea. The Hans Christian Andersen story was a key motivation for at least the ideas that I was expressing in that book. So I had to try and think of something else which would relate to what I was worrying about at the time, which were the foundations of quantum mechanics. And I thought and thought, and then I thought, The Little Mermaid. So that's Hans Christian Andersen's story. Of course, the Danes are very fond of it. In Copenhagen, you find this statue, which is represents this little mermaid. And there were various reasons in my talk which I could relate this to various things in quantum mechanics. But the key point, which that picture illustrates, I remember I was up late at night making this transparency with transparency pens, and my wife was trying to encourage me to go to bed. I drew that picture that you find on the back of the cover. And the thing about that picture is it's supposed to represent, and I say the one in the book too, but there's something a little bit extra in that one. The picture represents how we do quantum mechanics, in a sense. See, the bottom part of the picture is all under the water, and these are these strange fish and strange creatures which we don't understand properly, and all things are kind of entangled with seaweed and that kind of thing. So it's a great entanglement of things, a very strange, unfamiliar things. And that represents quantum mechanics. And then above, you have the world, the classical world of familiar things, of people walking around, boats, buildings, and separated objects, which seem to be able to behave as entities on their own. And that's the classical world. But the mermaid herself is sort of magical, and she is part fish and representing the in the quantum world, and part person representing the classical world. And but she is how you get, if you like, from the quantum world to the classical world. Now, the quantum world is governed by basically the Schrödinger equation. And there's a letter that I use there for U. U stands for what we call unitary evolution. Basically, that's the same thing. Unitary evolution is the Schrödinger equation. And Schrödinger himself was very worried because, in fact, you're probably familiar with the notion of the Schrödinger cat. That's because he was trying to say that his own equation doesn't make sense. Because saying you could make a cat which was alive and dead at the same time, and that would be perfectly in accordance with what the quantum evolution, according to his own equation, would behave like. In my book, I have a more humane version where the cat is trying to go through the door to a room on the other side, where there's some food on the other side. And one door, you see, you have a beam splitter which splits a photon which goes two ways, and this photon either opens one door or it opens the other door. And in quantum mechanics, both things are supposed to happen at the same time. So the cat goes through the door which is open and goes through the other door which is open at the same time, which is, of course, is ridiculous if we think of that as a thing we're familiar with, whereas the rules of quantum mechanics, in the sense of the Schrödinger equation, or the U thing, is what we, that's the way we do it. But then, how does that relate to the world? Well, you've got to cheat, you see. You say, well, you don't actually follow that equation, you do something completely different, which is called the collapse of the wave function, or the reduction of this quantum state. The world, I use the letter R for reduction of the quantum state, and that's what the mermaid represents. She has a tail in quantum mechanics, and then the top half of her is in the classical world. And how do you get from one to the other? Well, it's magic. You can't do that by following Schrödinger's rules. You have to wheel in another system of rules and then wheel them out again when you finish with them. It's sort of, you don't use quantum mechanics, people are a bit embarrassed by that. It works, you see.
Well, one of the audience asks actually about that a little bit.
Yes.
Whether it doesn't, wouldn't that say that there really isn't any objective physical reality if it changes when you look at it?
Well, a lot of people view it that way. See, I was never happy by that. Einstein was never happy with that. And I know one shouldn't point to authority, but you see, Einstein, Schrödinger, as I just said with his cat, de Broglie, who realized particles had to behave like waves and so on, and he had an equation for that. And more, even remarkably, Dirac, who was the person who really formulated the general framework of quantum mechanics that all quantum physicists use. And Dirac, therefore, was the big grand mogul of how you're supposed to do quantum mechanics. But he was a very modest and man who never expressed what he really felt very often. In later life, he tended to. And I got a nice quote in the book, which shows that he himself regarded quantum theory, current quantum theory, as a provisional theory, which needed something to replace it and that was better than it. So the faith here, you see, is a lot of physicists find, no, you've got to take the theory as it is. That really means you've got to take the U part, the Schrödinger equation, and it applies to the whole universe, and that means that the cat would be dead and alive at the same time. Somebody looks at the cat, then that person is split, in a sense, into one person seeing the dead one and the other seeing the live one. And that's what the equation would tell you to do, you see. And then they come to this idea of parallel worlds, which is inhabited by all the different possible things that could happen. But we only experience one world, and you really want a theory which describes that one world. And so the idea that I'm taking here is that quantum mechanics, as used, is incomplete, as I say, these four founders of the theory also agreed with. I should say there are others who didn't agree with that, so Heisenberg and Bohr and people were of a different view. But I feel I'm in pretty good company to think there's something has to be done about quantum mechanics. But the go ahead.
I suggest we go to cosmology soon, because the clock back there is ticking away.
Okay, I mean, you're saying that the mermaid represents that piece of magic, you see, which is which is Peter fantasy, although it's in the faith chapter. But it's a faith that somehow we believe the theory must be true at all levels. And whereas I think, no, there's going to be a level at which something changes.
Yeah.
Okay,
before we talk about the fantasy version, I think I have a unique opportunity, and the audience does too, to have you tell us a little bit about cosmology in the general sense.
Yes.
We have a great teacher here. Let's learn.
Well, I learned from a great teacher. Well, I say more than one, but mainly I went when I was a graduate student doing algebraic geometry.
Yes.
I got 3 years to do this. I don't have to start very soon. I can think about other things. And being in Cambridge, there were lots of good lectures and other subjects. And one was a lecture course given by Hermann Bondi, which is a wonderful course on general relativity and cosmology. And this is one of the things that fired me up about cosmology. Actually, even earlier than that, it was Schrödinger's little book on general relativity. Most people don't think of Schrödinger as a general relativity person.
No.
But he wrote a very nice little book, which I got some of the elements of that first. Second course was Dirac's on quantum mechanics. Amazing course also, but completely different. He didn't have the sort of fire that Bondi had, but he had the beautiful elegance, simple elegance all the way through it.
Interesting that great teaching can be in such different modes.
I think
that's one of the problems that people have in trying to evaluate it. And
that's right. They were very, very different, but I find equally inspiring. Mm-hmm. And another course I went to, again, nothing to do with what I was doing, was a course on mathematical logic by a man called Steen, and I learned about Gödel's theorem and Turing machines and all that. So these things had an influence on what I did later on.
But your most famous probably work is about black holes, at least in the physics world. What is a black hole anyway?
I should explain a little bit about the history of this.
Yes.
People say it started a long time ago before general relativity with a man by the name of Mitchell. But let's not talk about that. Black holes, as we understand them, where you really need to worry about them, I guess started with Chandrasekhar, who is an Indian physicist. I think he wasn't even, whether he was even 20, I'm not quite sure. He was on a boat from India to England to go and work, I suppose, under Eddington. And on the boat, he worked out about the forces, about stars called white dwarfs. These are Sirius is a double star, and there was this dark companion of it, which is very mysterious to people because it was what people later called a white dwarf, which is the mass of the sun concentrated into the size of the Earth, more or less. Think of that. But this is the thing that holds it apart, prevents it from collapsing, is a quantum mechanical phenomenon. It's to do with the Pauli exclusion principle. Identical particles can't be on top of each other if they're like particles like electrons and neutrons and so on. And Chandrasekhar showed that there had to be a limit to the size or the mass of such a star. And if it was bigger than that, well, he wrote an article with sort of modestly saying, we don't know, we left speculating. But Eddington, who was his teacher, I guess, in Cambridge that he went to, objected very strongly and thought this was all nonsense and there was a great fuss about it. I won't go into all that. But it was really the first hint that you had a collapse which was unstoppable. And this came from Chandrasekhar's work. If we fast forward to just before the Second World War, 1939, there was an important paper written by Oppenheimer and his student Schneider, where they examined what happened to an exactly spherically symmetrical body as it collapsed. According to Einstein's general theory of relativity, and it was made of dust, which is a material which didn't have any pressure. When I say made of, this is all theoretical, of course. So with this body, spherical body, which collapsed and nothing would stop it, and so it crumple up into this tiny little point where everything was going to focus to that point. And there were lots of arguments at that time as to whether this was a real thing or just a feature of the rather simple equations of motion, equations of state, which were the dust, but more importantly, the fact that everything was symmetrical. And a little bit later, when I was in Princeton, and a bit later when I was back home in England, there were some Russians who had seemed to have proved, this was Belinsky, Lifshitz and Kolatnikov, seemed to have proved that if you had a general case without symmetry, you wouldn't get this singularity. The thing would collapse and whoosh around and come out again. And that's what a lot of people believed. And so I thought about this a bit, and rather than going into long stories, unless you want me to, came to the conclusion, using techniques which were not like the things that people usually use. Either people would solve the equations exactly, which meant looking at very symmetrical cases, or else they would use computers to work out what were general cases. In fact, they weren't using computers at that time then. They didn't have good enough computers. But I tried to think about this problem much more as a problem in what, well, the subject referred to as differential topology. I was always a little bit...
I think this shows how much you're a mathematician as well as a physicist.
Yes.
Because physicists love to calculate things, and if they can compute a solution, that's fine.
Well, yes.
Whereas the mathematical approach is much more qualitative.
That's right. You have a qualitative argument. There was a film... There was also the film that was just not so long ago out, which starred Stephen Hawking and so on. Well, not him really, but...
Yes.
The Red Mid did a very good imitation of Stephen. It was really good. But
maybe you could tell us a little bit about that film.
Yes. Perhaps I should say about that, yes. You see, there's a part in the film where there is a person who carries my name. He's called Roger Penrose. he doesn't, I think, look anything like me. He's a lot bigger than I am, for one thing. And he was giving a lecture which, as far as I could see, didn't resemble any lecture I'd ever given. I think on a sideboard there were some pictures he didn't refer to, which I think were supposed to be some of mine, I'm not sure. And there, sitting in the audience, this was a lecture given in London, and in the audience was Stephen Hawking, with his eyes, you know, going and being inspired by this wonderful thing, you see. And the problem with that is, I mean, okay, I say it wasn't like me or my lecture, but the other problem was Stephen wasn't actually there. So that was not quite accurate. It's not as bad as it sounds, because Dennis Sharma invited me to give a repeat of the lecture in Cambridge a few months later, which I did. And Stephen Hawking was at that lecture, but it's not the one that was shown in the movie. And I talked to Stephen one-to-one or one-to-two, he and George Ellis, about the techniques I was using. And Stephen learned about them then and incorporated them really very quickly. First of all, had a way of using my exact theorem in a different context to show it applied to cosmology, which is a clever idea. And then he developed the techniques much more to try and apply them to cosmological situations.
You told me a little bit about the lecture in which you saw how to combine these. Perhaps you could...
Yes. I had to give a course of lectures in Seattle. This was... it was at a time when mathematicians and physicists were not really talking to each other. And John Wheeler and Cecile DeWitt wanted to organize a meeting where they got a lot of very distinguished mathematicians, pure mathematicians, and a lot of distinguished physicists. And then they asked me to give a series of 12 talks, I think it was, which were supposed to be on things which related mathematics to physics. I made a sort of mistake in these lectures of talking about something which I had previously talked to a very distinguished mathematician, Saunders McLean, and I talked
my advisor, by the way.
Really?
Yes.
I see. And he was one of the few mathematicians who really got interested in something I was doing. He said, yeah, that's a really good idea. So I got chuffed up. I thought, oh, I'll tell these people at this conference. And I did what I didn't realize, that they physicists thought, well, we know all that. That's just what we do all the time. It was really a way of interpreting the way they did it, you see. And the mathematicians said, what are these people, what are we learning about this stuff? This is all old-fashioned coordinate stuff. It wasn't, you see. It was a bad mistake, my doing that. So I wasted too many lectures on that. And then I had to tell all these singularity theorems. There was one point that struck me particularly before I got to that. I was describing the black hole thing, the symmetrical case that Oppenheimer and Schneider did. And this was doing a kind of coordinate transformation where you showed, but it looked like a singularity, and suddenly it disappeared, you see. And I remember seeing in the audience there was Steenrod, who was at this meeting, a very distinguished mathematician and really powerful geometer, and he was completely astounded by this. Because it's a kind of intuition that you takes a while to build up in the kind of geometry that you have for relativity, where it's an indefinite signature. I mean, that's a technical word, but it's where it's not the kind of differential geometry, the kind of curved space geometry that pure mathematicians usually use. You have a different kind of intuition from this. And it didn't strike me until I saw, you know, the expression on Steenrod's face that it was really a very different kind of intuition. Mm-hmm. But that's a sort of not what I was going to say here. I think there were two lectures left. One of them I gave my talk on the singularity. It's like, oh my God, there's only one lecture left, and I've got to describe all Stephen Hawking's theorems, you see. So I spent, I don't know how much of the night I was up, and my wife telling me to go to bed and so on. And I finally realized you could have an argument which more or less gathered all these theorems together into one theorem. So I gave a sort of rapid version of that thing at this lecture.
So deadline pressure sometimes deadline has pressure. A good
sometimes
effect.
It works. Sometimes, yes. That's the case where it did work. But then when I got back to England, I guess Stephen may have heard about this, but he had independently produced a result which was very similar to the one I had. So we got together, we thought we should write a paper together, and well, we wrote one paper for the thing called the Gravity Prize, which is for relativity, and people have got rather keen on this. And we got second prize for the Gravity Prize.
Paper that got first prize is forgotten.
I've forgotten who got first prize. But anyway, but curiously enough, the big paper that we wrote on this was the collaboration was done almost entirely over the telephone. So we didn't, of course, have emails in those days. It was a little bit difficult to talk to Stephen because he had this condition. At that time, he could still talk, but the speech was certainly affected, but not drastically, so I could understand what he said over the telephone. I could understand it as long as it was mathematics. If he talked about the personal thing, what? It took ages to find out. But for some reason, it was much easier to talk about mathematics. But there was only one occasion where he actually came to visit me in London, where I was at the time, Birkbeck College, where we got together with a blackboard and talked seriously about it. Almost all of it was done on over the phone, which I think
did you find it exciting to talk to him? I mean, was there... Did you feel a spark?
We got on pretty well, and we could understand each other's way of thinking. Mm-hmm. So I think I may say it developed differently later on when we kind of diverged. But at the time, we were very much on thinking in the same way and about similar things, mm-hmm. and it was a very fruitful time. No, he had a lot of. He was very quick at picking up on these, both on the geometrical ideas and on analytical, calculational things as well. So,
Now, I think we have a lot of physicists in the audience, judging by the questions we've had. I'm going to stay away, I'm sorry, from the technical things, but I would be remiss if I didn't give you a chance to talk about cyclic
cosmology. I should talk
cosmology.
About the fantasy, yes.
Fantasy,
well, you see,
yes.
It's quite curious, because the titles I gave... I think I was working up a bit too early in the morning by the Princeton University Press, because I was supposed to give three lectures in Princeton about the things I was doing. And I gave them the title Fashion, Faith, and Fantasy in the New Physics of the Universe, which was probably a pretty rash thing to do, because some of the world experts, I should say the world experts, probably were there. But I don't think they were at my talk, which was fortunate. But nevertheless, I did talk about that. But the point I was going to make here is that the word fantasy was aimed specifically on current ideas about cosmology, which I didn't believe in, one of them being this idea of inflationary cosmology. The idea was, and still is, it's, I should say, quite unlike string theory, there is a good deal of experimental support. Quite unlike quantum mechanics, it doesn't kind of have a hugely beautiful mathematical basis. But it's an idea called inflation. It's supposed to have taken place within the first something like 10 to the minus 32 seconds, where you see 10 to the 32 means, imagine 1, 32 zeros, 1 over that number of seconds. So that's a tiny little blip of a second, much shorter than a blip, I don't know what you should call it. And in that tiny little time, the universe was supposed to have expanded exponentially. That means it grew in a way which was self-similar, so the amount of increase in size was in proportion to what the size was. And you have this exponential expansion taking place according to theory. Now, I just didn't think this made sense. How do you turn it off, for example, once you've got a thing like that going? And it is a problem, actually, turning it off, but they have their ways.
Isn't it supposed to be continuing in some places and not continuing
in
others?
Well, that's a couple of things that worry me. You'd have to get exactly right, or else it would do horribly different things over here and here.
Yeah.
That was one of the things that worried me. But the idea was, you see, the universe might have been very complicated and squish all over the place in the early days, and then this would iron it all out and make it smooth. I simply thought that was wrong. I still think it's wrong, that argument. In fact, the main arguments that were put forward in favor of it, I don't think were right. Well, apart from one which is sort of irrelevant. But then it became supported by certain types of observation. See, when the idea came first, I thought, well, that's not going to last a week, you see. I was completely wrong, of course. It's still there. And it's a major part of current cosmology. But I thought, and still think, for various reasons, it doesn't really make sense. But it does now have things that important things in its favor, which if you don't have another theory which could explain those things, you've got to have inflation. But I still didn't believe it. But in order to explain the things that inflation is needed for, either you really have inflation or else you need what you call a pre-Big Bang theory. So there must have been something going on before the Big Bang. Now, there are various theories of this nature, one going way back to the Friedman, who was the first person who solved Einstein's equations for cosmology, where you have a bouncing universe and that sort of thing, which has trouble with the singularity theorems. Others which were involving inflation ideas taking place before the Big Bang, an idea due to Veneziano. And then there is Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok, who had their own version of a pre-Big Bang theory. So there are such theories, but I wasn't very happy with any of them. And you see, the point I was... There's an irony here, you see, because the fantasy in that word was supposed to say, well, look, this is ridiculous, we don't want fantasy in physics, you see. But then in the meantime, I came up with my own theory, which was... It may well be regarded as a fantastical theory, and I'm sure it is by many people. So I sort of softened my view. I said, well, okay, fantasy's all right, it's just got to be the right fantasy.
So you even mocked yourself, calling it crazy cyclic cosmology.
Yes, well, I did sort of, yes, try to. Well, you see, my wife is very keen that I don't get too wrapped up and try to boast about the thing and say, oh, yes, it's got to be right, you see. So I'm calling it crazy and...
Now, also in your theory, if I understand it, in the distant future, before the next cycle somehow,
yeah,
the universe gets very thin.
Yes, yes, it does.
And there's not much there other than
very
few electrons or a few photons, perhaps.
Yes. Well, you see, this was, I was sitting in my office at home. I never have. Somebody asked me once, "Do you ever have a good idea in your office?" meaning my office at work. I said, thought to myself, no, I don't think I ever had. Either it's been walking in the park, or you know, or at the dinner, or lying on the floor, or whatever it happens to be, or in my office at home. Yes. Well, here I think I was lying on the floor at home, probably, having this rather miserable thought that, you see, the universe is doing this exponential expansion. This is an observed fact. It's doing that. It's also a fact that Einstein's equations of, not the original equations that he had in 1916, but the mild modification that he put in for the wrong reason in 1917, caused the cosmological constant, really does explain this exponential expansion that we see. People call it the mysterious dark energy, but I like to call it Einstein's cosmological constant, because he got there first, even though he tried to retract it, but never mind. The universe seems to be doing this expansion, this exponential expansion. Okay, well, this means that it gets colder and colder and colder. And then I call it, that's what's the boring age. The boring age is when nothing interesting there is except a few black holes. Now, these black holes eventually will evaporate away, because Stephen Hawking explained that these black holes have a temperature. Okay, ridiculously tiny, because the hottest ones around are the smallest ones, and they're about the temperatures, sort of temperature, the lowest temperatures ever been made on the Earth, so it's not really very hot. The bigger ones are much colder, and the supermassive ones are enormously colder. However, the universe is going to go on doing this expansion in about a googol years. That means a googol is this number one with 100 zeros. In about that many years, the big ones will start to go evaporate away and go disappear with a pop. And I thought, that's the very boring era when that's all gone, you see. And so I was sitting there being pretty, I don't know, it's an emotional argument, I admit, but I was sitting there thinking, this amazing universe, and forever and ever, that's what we're in for. This very boring, stupid universe with nothing going on, getting thinner and thinner and thinner, and what's the use of it, sort of thing. Emotional argument, yes, I agree with that. But then I thought, okay, it's not going to be boring to us, because no, we're not going to be there. But who's going to be there? Well, mainly photons. And it's really difficult to bore a photon. Well, photons probably don't have experiences, but that's not what I mean. The photon, well, let's say, call it experience, but a photon doesn't experience time. You see, it's the way that relativity works. The faster things move, the slower time works. And if it goes at the speed of light, the first tick of a clock to the next tick is right out to infinity. So if there are just photons around, infinity is no big deal. It's just a place that they get to eventually. And it's a thing that I'd been playing around for other reasons in relativity. You could represent, squash that infinity down. It's what we call a conformal map. Squash it down, and it makes a finite boundary, and you can talk about what goes on at the boundary. It's very useful if you want to talk about gravitational waves and things like that. But then,
you put it once by saying that to a photon, there's zero time between the time it's born and the time it
dies.
That's
right, yeah.
Right. It has traveled the length of the universe.
The speed of light, there's no time for a photon. Here and there is no time. Hard to believe, but that's the way relativity works. So I thought, okay, well, those photons, well, where do they go? They get to this boundary. What's on the other side? Well, I began thinking about the other problem. What about the Big Bang, you see? Well, there's the real problem about the Big Bang is that it goes back to the inflation thing. Why is it so smooth? And so, well, there are lots of ideas about that, but they don't really explain it. And it seemed to me that you have to understand. Well, the first thing I worried about is how do you describe mathematically how smooth it is? And I had this thing called the Weyl curvature hypothesis. Don't worry about that. I'm not going to talk about it.
You want to say what smoothness means in this context?
It means...
What does it mean to say the Big Bang was smooth?
Well, I could sort of think of an example. You could imagine one of these... I can't turn it upside down, but that would be dangerous. But you could have a lot of wrinkles in it, you see. This is a nice smooth... That could represent our future infinity, you see, that little future... Okay, this is not enough dimensions, because you've got one dimension of space going around it, one dimension of time going up that way, and this could be infinity up there. That would be space of infinity. Now I'm not going to turn the glass upside down because I'll get wet, but the Big Bang is something like that the other way up. But most Big Bang, you see, if it's not smooth, you'd have to imagine it look like a sawtooth here, wrinkles all over the place, a great mess, instead of having a nice smooth edge. And most, you see, if you imagine that now as a collapsing universe, suppose it's a collapsing universe, then what does it collapse to? It collapses, all the black holes and things will get mixed up with each other and they will make an incredible mess at the end. That incredible mess is quite different from the very smooth universe. But the Big Bang, and that's why I would want to turn the glass upside down, but I won't. Imagine it's
here
upside down. Ah, that's what I want. upside down. and that now represents the Big Bang, you see. Now, the thing is, it was very smooth, curiously, and this is a big mystery.
How do we know it's smooth?
Well,
how do we know?
Yeah, I should tell you about my mammoth in the room, probably.
Yes.
Should I tell you about the mammoth in the room? You see, let me tell you about one of the most important laws in physics is the second law of thermodynamics. What does it say? It says things get more and more random as time goes on, roughly speaking. More technically, it says a thing called entropy, which is, roughly speaking, a measure of randomness, entropy increases. So this entropy, measure of randomness, increases as time goes on. Okay, pretty depressing law, but nevertheless, that's the second law of thermodynamics. What is this? I just say the same thing again a different way now. Suppose you go back in time, then things get less and less random. Entropy goes down and down and down and down until you get to the Big Bang. Well, what's the best evidence that the Big Bang was there? Well, there's this thing called the microwave background. Got the Nobel Prize twice. Once for the discovery by accident, and once by its analysis with satellites and things like that. What's the most impressive piece of evidence that there was a Big Bang? Well, it's this radiation. And this radiation coming to us is very cold because the universe is expanding and cooled it down. But early, in the very early universe, very, very hot. And it was not just hot. It was very uniform around the sky, but it was also, people sent the satellite up and they measured the frequency spectrum. So what this means is you look for different frequencies. You have a graph going on the x-axis is the different frequencies, usually getting higher this way, lower and lower that way. And this is, no, have I got it the wrong way? I'm on the wrong way around. Yes, it looks more or less the same whichever way around it is. I think it's the higher frequencies on this end. And it goes up like this and comes down. That's the famous Planck curve. And the radiation fits in with this perfectly. It's an absolutely beautiful example of this frequency curve. And this, what does it tell you? It tells you it's what people call black body radiation. What does that mean? Well, it means maximum entropy. Maximum entropy. So what you're looking back and back and back and back, where the entropy should be going down and down until you get to a maximum. We don't have to be a brilliant mathematician to see there's something funny going on there, because it should, maybe it could be a minimum, but, you know, down to a maximum, it doesn't make any sense. Well, people say, well, the universe was pretty small in those days. No, that's not the right answer. Don't worry about it. It's not the right answer. What is the right answer? Well, the right answer is that what you're looking at is radiation and matter sort of in equilibrium, expanding too, but that's not important. They're in equilibrium, and that gives you this beautiful Planck curve, big frequencies down to the small ones. I think it's that way around, yes. Now, isn't that a contradiction? Well, it's the mammoth in the room. I say, well, shouldn't you be worried about this? Well, it's not a contradiction, because the entropy is low, but only in gravity. And the fact that it's very uniform is another statement of that. See, what happens as the universe evolves, this very uniform matter starts to clump. You get material clumping, and then you get stars, and they shine. They get bright spots. This thing makes it. You have galaxies, most particularly stars. For us, we get the sun. And we live off the sun being a bright spot in a dark sky. And it could only do that because of the potential to produce this big temperature anisotropy, which is a low entropy situation which we live off. That's why life is around, because the sun is a bright spot in a dark sky. And that is an amazing thing. And it's low only because this potential to clump was there. And this is an extraordinarily special state. So when I say the mammoth in the room, it's this extraordinary imbalance between gravity and everything else, which needs explaining. And I've so many lectures or articles I've seen by famous cosmologists and say, well, what are the remaining problems of cosmology? We'll say it's dark energy, dark matter, and galaxy formation, and this coincidence, and that and that. Do I see anywhere this thing of the total imbalance between gravity and everything else? No, it's not mentioned. So it seemed to me this is an important driving force. We need an explanation for this. And as far as I'm aware, well, now I have to tie it in with the story of before, which is that, okay, my colleague Paul Todd in Oxford had a nice way of saying mathematically how this Big Bang was special. So this is the cup turned up the way, not a rough edge here, but a smooth edge, conformally, in the same way we were talking about with the infinity here, how it's squashing it down, here's it stretching it out. I should say conformally means squashing and stretching so that the shapes of things, small shapes, remain the same. So it squashes the same amount in all directions. It's a very interesting mathematical notion, or angles are preserved, if you like. That's a better way of saying it. And I used to play around when I was young with geometries of circles and all this sort of stuff. It's a very beautiful kind of geometry. Not thinking of anything in particular, but later on it became a very nice way of thinking about cosmology. And most of physics, you see, the thing is that it's hard to see this, but most of physics is really independent of the scale. Most particularly the wonderful equations of Maxwell, which describe electricity, magnetism, and light. And these equations don't care about the scale. It works just as well if it's small or as big. The only thing that doesn't, as far as we know, like this change of scale and really needs the scale, is mass, or things to do with mass. And or mass and gravity, that needs to know this too. So if you don't have any mass, and we were talking about the photons don't have any mass, and so they don't care about the scale. So I can use this picture. They get out to infinity, and there they are. What about the other end? Well, the other end, that's the Big Bang. Why do we say that the conformal stuff makes sense here again? Well, now it's for a completely different reason. It gets hotter and hotter and hotter, and the particles get so energetic that their mass becomes totally irrelevant. That is to say, the energy in their mass, the E equals mc squared, energy in their mass, is completely swamped by the energy of their motion. And this gets more and more true the closer you get to the Big Bang. So again, the physics is the physics of conformal geometry, and you can do the squashing and stretching, and the physics doesn't notice it. So what I'm saying is, okay, stretch it out now. Stretch out this little point we think of as the Big Bang, make it this boundary, and if you can do that, then you get a situation where the gravitational degrees of freedom are suppressed, just like the sort of thing we see. So I thought, that's a brilliant way of looking at it. And here's the crazy idea. All that's sensible. This is the crazy idea, that the remote future becomes the Big Bang of another, what I call, eon. In fact, our Big Bang, there was something going on before. It was this exponential expansion of the previous eon. Now, you might say, how does this cold, boring, very boring future of the previous eon become this hot, dense Big Bang? Well, they're equivalent. Once you don't have any mass, you can stretch one and squash the other. If you squash the remote future, it gets very hot. If you stretch out the very hot Big Bang, it gets very cold. And physically, they become completely equivalent. So this is the crazy idea. And I'm saying, okay, is it crazy enough, is the question. So I'm not minding it being fantasy. I'm just saying, is it the right fantasy?
I have, at this point, to interrupt and remind the radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, that our guest today is the renowned theoretical physicist and mathematician Sir Roger Penrose. I'm David Eisenbud, director of the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute. And that concludes my duty of that kind. I wanted to turn to some of the questions from the audience, and one of them was very relevant to what you've just been saying. What experiments are most needed now to make a step forward in theory?
I think probably the most important is to test the limits of quantum mechanics. And there are experiments which are at present underway. There are several. The one I know best is by a Dutchman named Dirk Bouwmeester, who works, well, it's like it's a bad pun to say he's in a superposition of Santa Barbara and Leiden in the Netherlands, but he shares his time between both places. And for a long time, he's been developing an experiment in which you have a little tiny mirror. The mirror is so small you couldn't quite see it. Its dimensions are about a tenth of the thickness of a human hair. And the idea is that you take a photon, you split it into two. You can do this by hitting it with sometimes you call it a half-silvered mirror or a beam splitter. So the photon goes through it and is reflected at the same time. It's sort of, you say it's split into two, but it's a superposition.
Like the cat.
Like the cat, Schrödinger's cat, exactly, yes. So it goes this way and that way at the same time, which you can do if you're a particle. It's a bit harder if you're a real cat. But the idea is that the bit that goes this way is caught in a cavity and it reflects backwards and forwards between two mirrors. The one that comes the other way hits this little tiny mirror, reflects off it, and there's another mirror which is a bit like a hemisphere, and the thing comes back and goes like this. You see, it keeps hitting it. Now, when it hits the little mirror, when the photon, the part of the photon wave that is trapped in this little funny cavity, when it hits the little mirror, it's on a sort of spring, so it pushes it down. And you have to hit it by maybe something like a million times. It's like a diver jumping up and down on a diving board, but a million times. And it slightly moves this little mirror. And it will move it by about the diameter of an atomic nucleus, not much, in maybe a second or a minute, depending on the details. So the idea is that you let it do this for a second or a minute, depending on details, and then you try to get the two parts of the photon back again and see whether they're coherent again or have they lost coherence. They will have lost coherence if this little mirror at some point decides, whoops, I'm going to be either here or here, not in a superposition of the two. And the idea is that there is a limit and that we will see that it does one or the other. And that we don't know yet. Personally, I think that is sort of around the corner, not like many of these experiments which have to do with quantum mechanics and gravity, which are simply way off the picture, and there's no chance of doing experiments. This is a real plausible experiment. Now, what I think is needed is more than just the experiment. Let's suppose it does. I'm going to be optimistic from my point of view, pessimistic maybe from others, to say that quantum mechanics will fail at this point, and so the mirror does decide I've got to be either here or here, not in a superposition of one or the other. So it's a Schrödinger's cat at this point making its decision as to which it must be, and that is a violation of quantum mechanics as we know it, but it does it because of a conflict between the principles of quantum mechanics and general relativity. So the basic principles of general relativity, if you follow them through, you see there's a conflict with those of quantum mechanics. And my argument is that these principles of general relativity will somehow win out in this circumstance and show that the mirror's got to be one or the other.
That's a
very interesting
fancy experiment.
Sorry.
I have so many physics questions. I'm going to ask you one which is relatively elementary and one which is not so elementary.
Okay.
One is, how can you see into the past with a telescope?
Ah, yes, well, you see into the past. It's these wonderful photons. You see, light travels with, as you might expect, the speed of light. And this means, it's very useful, I find, to draw a diagram where time is going upwards and space sideways. And then you see, we like to draw it so that the speed of light is at 45 degrees. It's a very unrealistic from the point of view of normal measurements, but never mind. The speed of light is particles going along this line here. So you imagine us sitting at a certain point, and we're looking back into the past, because light has got to take time to get to us. And so light, which is a million light years away, I mean, if the source of the light is a million light years away, that's a long way, it takes a million years for it to get to us. Now, of course, the photon doesn't think it takes a million years because it thinks it's only instantaneous from its creation point to its observation point. But if you take it from the time scale of a stationary observer, so the person sitting on the Earth, well, more or less stationary, looking out at the observable universe, looking back into the time, past time, because the light has taken, with respect to that kind of frame of reference, a million years to take. It'll take a million years to get to us if it's a million light years away, and so on if it's more, and so on or if it's less.
So you're seeing what was a million years ago.
You see what was, and it's very fortunate in a way, because this means we know what the universe was like millions and millions of years ago, because we just look out far enough, and if we've got good enough telescopes or radio telescopes or gravitational wave telescopes, then we will be seeing what was going on really early on in those early days.
So here's a harder one, and I hesitate to ask it because the answer could take another hour. But nevertheless, in this cyclical universe,
yes,
the entropy has been decreasing for a long time, and suddenly it seems, is it still decreasing after
a very good question.
What's happening to the entropy?
You might think that I have thought about it, although it did take me quite a while to realize what I think is the real answer. And it's an interesting question. Now, you might ask, first of all, where is most of the entropy in the universe now? It's in supermassive black holes. So the center of our galaxy...
You know, I thought it was in my study.
Sorry?
I thought it was in my study.
No, that's chicken feed. Even my study is chicken feed. You haven't seen my study. I've seen yours. that's utter chicken feed. In fact, people used to think the microwave background coming in all the way, that's really high entropy compared with most things. Chicken feed. What's the real entropy is in these huge black holes. So it's far, far more than anything else in the universe. Okay, that's only one point. So you might ask, what happens to the black holes? Well, you get to the boring universe, and then you get to the very boring part of the universe, and the black holes evaporate away. Well, what happens to all the entropy? Well, you see, it's a controversial issue. It's a curious thing, because Stephen Hawking was on both sides of this argument. He originally said that information, or let's say degrees of freedom, information is lost in black holes, so that when they evaporate away, it gulps down all the degrees of freedom or the information that black hole swallowed, and it's gone. And he tried to develop a theory in which that made sense, but his theory was a bit too mild, I think. But later on, he changed his mind, and he said, oh no, you've got to get that information back again. And it was more of a majority view. And the reason it's a majority view, it's curious, you see, because it relates to other things I was saying here, is that to lose information violates unitarity. Now, unitarity is this letter U I was using. That's the Schrödinger equation. That's the part of the mermaid which is under the water. And so many physicists have this quantum faith that at all levels, even as the level of a black hole, you must not violate unitarity. That's, you know, thou shalt not violate unitarity, you see. Now, I'm saying, no, this is not going to last that long. So I think Stephen Hawking was right the first time. Yes, it does violate unitarity. It does violate the Schrödinger equation. It's a good example of a Schrödinger's cat, in a sense, which has now become, well, not a Schrödinger, but it's become one or the other. It's that violation of this standard rules of unitary evolution, quantum mechanics evolution, as we...
So the entropy is evaporated away?
It's not evaporated away. It's more...
I have to stop.
It's slightly more subtle. Let me just say it.
Yeah.
The point is, what do you mean by entropy? Do you count the entropy in those black holes when it's all gone? Now, it's degrees of freedom. There is a technical definition of entropy which depends on all the degrees of freedom, and you count how big a volume is taking into consideration all those degrees of freedom. But if some of them have been swallowed up by the holes, and the holes are the most important ingredient in the entropy in the universe, and you've now thrown away all those degrees of freedom, you scratch your head and say, whoops, I shouldn't really be using all those for my definition of entropy. So it's not that there's any violation of the second law, that the entropy comes walloping down again. No, it's that you have to change your mind and say, oh, that's the wrong definition. I should be using a definition which doesn't use those degrees of freedom. And then the new definition is lower. So it's a sneaky way of having your cake and eating it. The second law is still there because you've shifted your view. And I think that's the right answer. But it's a subtle one and a very subtle question. And thank you for the question.
I think, unfortunately, that was the last question. But I do want to say one more anyway. What are the books besides yours that you'd recommend to the young generation to read about physics?
Besides mine?
Besides yours. That's specified in the question.
I'm sure it's not mine anyway. So, I'm not really... at what level were we looking here, I guess?
Young people, let's say, let's say 10 years.
Before they got to
college. Before calculus.
Well, I learned an awful lot. I mean, I don't know. No, it's still in print. For these wonderful books by George Gamow.
Me too. Me
yes.
too.
The one was called,
It's 1, 2, 3, infinity, but there are...
Oh, no, that's something else. No, that's probably... No, the Gamow ones, one was called... maybe there was one called that. Oh dear.
Anyway, go out and find the books of George Gamow.
Yes.
That they really were a pleasure to
read. My older brother used to read me these things, and I found utterly fascinating. One of them is on quantum mechanics. Mr. Tompkins Wonderland, that's the quantum mechanics one. No, that's the relativity one. Mr. Tompkins in Wonderland... Mr. Tompkins explores the atom. That's the quantum mechanics one.
Sorry to say that we have to thank you and go home. Noted theoretical physicist and mathematician and author of the new book, Fashion, Faith, and Fantasy in the New Physics of the Universe. And I thank the audience, too, here and on the radio and television and the Internet. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.